Welcome, friends, to Worst Foot Forward, the podcast that celebrates the best of the worst. And welcome, once again, to our bonus episode, The Third Foot, which has been grafted onto the cadaver of the podcast by an overambitious evil professor. I am Ben Vandervelde, or to give my full title, Ben Vandervelde's Monster. And with me is the evil genius who absolutely did not make me, unless my parents have been lying to me very inventively for the past 38 years, but who, for the process of this narrative, will act as the evil doctor. It's Barry McStay. Hello, Barry.
Ooh, what? There hasn't been a Barry McStay here for 25 years.
Oh, my word. I see dead actors.
We're doing a Halloween special, Third Foot. I don't know how it's taken us this long.
Well, I looked back at the records. We did one for our Patreon pals a couple of years ago, but I'm pretty certain the stuff I'm going to talk about wasn't on that. I've looked at three big things to do with sort of Halloween and the, I was going to say the Netherworld, but it's not really the Netherworld.
The Netherlands.
The Netherlands, yes, that's it. So it's a big Halloween tradition to wear clogs and brandish tulips everywhere you go, and then to put skulls on windmills. And the orange that is worn by the football team is representative of the orange blood that flows from pumpkins. Oh no, pumpkins, damn, so close. Anyway. To business. I began looking at the world of pumpkins, and in particular, something that we love on this podcast is rural games, or things that shouldn't be games turned into games. And if you go to rural America, you can take part in pumpkin chucking, which is
nice.
A sport. The World Pumpkin Chucking Championships have been held annually in Delaware from 1985 to 2013. Why did they end in 2013? Well, because of a series of lawsuits.
Oh no, why?
Boringly, due to, I think, them not being able to get sufficient insurance to cover what they were doing, and because of one injury. And obviously, America, quite a litigious country. But don't worry, if you want to take part in the Europeans, you can go to Bixschotter in Belgium, where it's been held every year from 2004. Now, my main question for you, Barry, is how do you think the pumpkins are chucked in this competition?
Now, I have two thoughts on the matter. One is that it's the, you know, like a shot put, and it's, you know, in under the head, over the shoulder. And my hope is that they attach a chain or a wire to the stalk of it, like they're throwing the hammer instead.
I mean, both of those would be glorious and remarkable, but I'm afraid you're wrong on both counts, because this is very much a festival of engineering. According to what I've read, the pumpkins are chucked using slingshots, catapults, centrifugals, pneumatic cannons, and trebuchets.
Pumpkin trebuchet sounds like a very posh child that I was at school with. Yeah.
So, bearing in mind the use of the pumpkin trebuchet, the Guinness World Record is actually held by a pneumatic cannon dubbed Big 10-inch. How far in meters did you think Big 10-inch was able to fire a pumpkin on September the 9th, 2010?
So, presumably 10-inch is the size of the pumpkin. It's the caliber of pumpkin that they're firing.
I presume so, yeah, it must be.
Which is not a massive pumpkin. And it had to fire... How far did a pneumatic cannon fire a 10-inch pumpkin?
Yeah, now this, I must point out, this is the official Guinness World Record. It's not the World Champion World Record, because this world record took place in Moab, Utah. The one in the World Championships is actually a degree shorter. Apparently it is thought because in Utah there is higher, thinner, drier air. So
just
going to
say,
on the pumpkin.
Yeah. Let's go for 100 metres.
You are out by a factor of about 16. It was fired 1,690 metres.
Why? And they wonder why injuries occurred. I'll tell you why injuries occurred, because some woman's hanging out her washing a kilometre away from the pumpkin tossing grounds. When a 10-inch pumpkin shoots through a duvet cover and brains her.
I'm just imagining her turning up at the pearly gates covered in pumpkin mulch and St. Peter being like, what have you been doing, madam? I was just innocently hanging out with my washing and whoomp, out of nowhere, this pumpkin got me.
Like a driving range. You sometimes get driving ranges where they have like they have to hang a net at the end of it because they don't want people who can hit the ball particularly far carrying the ball 300 yards or whatever. Mm-hmm. A kilometer.
Yeah.
Okay.
And the prize for this, Barry, with more than 100 teams competing, is a £1,500 trophy and zero prize money. Just remarkable, isn't it? One last thing on the pumpkin chucking. Some of the team names, obviously cracking. We have Young Glory 3, American Chunker Incorporated, Second Amendment 2, the Hormone Blaster. Hey, listen, I would be absolutely all right for the right to bear arms if it was only pumpkin trebuchets.
And pea shooters.
Yeah, who wouldn't want to see that duel? I mean, it would make Hamilton be a very different play. Yeah. Aaron Burr and Alexander Hamilton lobbing legumes at each other.
Angelica, Eliza, and Pumpkin.
Yeah, but my favourite, the winner at the last championship that was able to take place in 2019, Chunk Norris.
Okay. America be America then.
America being American, staying in America for, well, indeed, all of this. I had just a little look at where the tradition of trick-or-treating comes from. Apparently, not in any way connected to Halloween, but the notion of going door-to-door and singing songs goes all the way back to ancient Greece. A writer called Athenaeus of Naucratis recorded in his book The Deipnosophists that on the island of Rhodes, children used to go door to door dressed as swallows, sing a song, and then demand either food or they would cause mischief to the owners of the house.
It's essentially glorified blackmail.
Oh yeah, absolutely. And then but there's been various offshoots of it. And in America, there was something called Ragamuffin Day, which the holiday was formed around 1870, a few years after Thanksgiving became a national holiday. Basically, children would again go door to door seeking candy. They would deliberately dress up as beggars and the homeless, which feels somewhat distasteful.
Yeah.
Again, America going to America in the past, going to past. It did develop a little, so the children moved on from being beggars and homeless to sailors and bandits. So I can only presume that the tradition was going through a development. So by now, I guess they'd be dressing up as Gordon Gecko and robber barons and leaders of industry and exploiting wage labour from the working classes.
Yeah.
You'll be unsurprised to know Ragamuffin Day decreased in popularity during the Great Depression. As you can imagine, like kids turning up dressing up as the homeless on people's doors going, yeah, now's not the time, little one.
Yeah.
But it has been commemorated. There's a street in Bay Ridge that has been renamed Ragamuffin Way in honour of the tradition. But my thing that I'm going to talk about most is the first silly fact that I found about, another world record, was the world's largest Ouija board. How large in square foot do you think the world's largest Ouija board was?
It's got to be like the size of a football pitch or several football pitches. I'm going for 4 football pitches.
Like, I don't know the footage of a football pitch, but no, it's not that big. It's 1,302 square foot.
A football pitch is 76,000 square foot.
So. Yeah, so you are out again. So the first time round you went too small, this time round you went too high.
So this is about the size of the small box inside the penalty area.
Yeah, it was created on the roof of the Grand Midway Hotel in Wind Bear, Pennsylvania, which is apparently a very haunted hotel. And Blair Murphy, who put it together, said apparently things flipped out throughout the hotel. Energies were swirling. Guests were getting freaked out. It seemed to kick an entirely new level of paranormal activity off. We were seeing...
Is it because they nailed a Ouija board through some wires on the roof of the building?
Yes, almost certainly. And we were seeing floating people and hearing voices, and even the hotel pets were flipping out and reacting to unforeseen forces.
Hearing voices. It's just got pin walls, mate.
Yeah, that's definitely what it is. Now, this is the official world record. The unofficial one, was made in Salem, Massachusetts.
Those guys really know their brand, don't they?
Yep, and was referred to as Ouija-Zilla.
They don't have to fight Ouija Mothra.
Yeah. Well, yeah, but it made the lights keep flickering on and off. Yeah. It's a paranormal activity, and it just baffled him. The board weighed 9,000 pounds. It was large enough to park 5 full-size 18-wheeler vehicles on. And the planchet, which is the piece that's moved around the board, weighed 400 pounds and was big enough for a man to stand on. It measured in at 3,168 square feet. But I don't know why it's an unofficial world record. I don't know. I presume one of the Guinness World Records people turned up to try and measure it, and they immediately were sent to the dungeon dimensions.
Yeah, through the gates of hell.
Yeah. But I then decided, you know what, I should probably look up the history of the Ouija board. How long do you reckon Ouija boards have been about for, Barry?
They're either ancient or they're like a Victorian thing. It's usually one of those two. I'm going Victorians.
Yeah, well, American Victorians. But February 1891 is when the first adverts appear in the papers for Ouija, the wonderful talking board. That is from a Pittsburgh toy shop. And I think at first it was sort of seen as kind of like a magic eight ball. And what's interesting is that this, when a gentleman called Robert Murch, who's a historian of the Ouija board, started looking into its origins, they were quite murky. No one really knew where they came from, because obviously this was the great age of spiritualism. Hmm. And what the Ouija board was the answer to was the fact that before then, spiritualists would communicate with the dead by calling out the alphabet and waiting for a knock at the right letter. And basically, this was seen as slow and cumbersome. So the Ouija board was, you know, the difference between Wi-Fi and dial-up.
They're dragging interdimensional telepathic messaging into the industrial age.
Absolutely.
Mass-producing ghost messages.
In 1886, it was reported by the Associated Press about a talking board that was being used at spiritualist camps in Ohio. And a businessman called Charles Kennard in Baltimore, Maryland, acted on this. And he pulled together a group with some other investors, including a chap called Elijah Bond, who was a local attorney, and Colonel Washington Bowie.
He was a local attorney?
No. A local attorney.
Wow, this podcast just got spooky.
Yeah. And together they formed the Kennard Novelty Company to exclusively make and market Ouija boards. They were not spiritualists. They were entrepreneurs. Mm. And another key part was Elijah Bond's sister-in-law, Helen Peters, who apparently also worked as a medium. She sat down around the table with them all. And apparently she asked the board what it should be called, and the name Ouija came through. The traditional explanation of why a Ouija board is called a Ouija board is that it's a mixture of oui and ya, French and German. That is apparently not true. Apparently what happened is this. And when Helen Peters asked the board again what Ouija meant, the board simply replied, good luck. Now, you and me know, and hopefully a lot of our listeners know, the way it works, and I've forgotten the particular psychological or physiological term, is that if either one person has their hand on the planchette, or if there's five of us sat around the table and we all have it on, your hand will subconsciously move it two letters. It's been proven in psychological experiments. I know Derren Brown has done stuff on this. It was the same with table turning, which was a big thing that was used by spiritualists, where apparently you would be able to lay your hands on the table and all to stand up and lift the table round and round.
Oh yeah, that was what was her name? Lazy Susan, I think her name was, that spiritualist in particular.
Was that really it? No, that's a joke, isn't it?
That's a joke about Lazy Susans, Ben.
Good, I was just checking.
Her brother was a mute waiter.
Good old industrious Jeffrey.
I'm just amusing myself now.
But apparently, it's very possible that Peters was wearing a locket bearing the picture of a woman, and the woman had the name Ouida above her. And Ouida is a quite a popular women's rights activist. Mm-hmm. So there is a chat. Almost certainly what happened there is that either deliberately or subconsciously that was misread, and that's how he ended up with Ouija. Once they had formed this company and created the design for the board, next they had to get a patent. Now, the problem with getting patents for something like this is that in order for the Board of Patents to give you one, it has to be proved that the item in question works. How do you prove that this works when it is clearly hokum?
Do they do a miracle on 34th Street and they go, well, on the dollar bill it says, in God we trust. In ghosts we communicate.
Yeah, you see this little eye in a pyramid on the dollar bill. Look into the eye, not around the eye, yeah. But right into the eye. No, so the chief patent officer said if the board could accurately spell out his name, which was supposed to be unknown to Elijah Bond and Helen Peters, he would allow the patent application to proceed. They sat down, communed with the spirit, and the planchette faithfully spelled out his name. Now, maybe it was mystical spirits, or maybe the fact that Elijah Bond was a patent attorney meant that he probably knew the guy's name and could just spell it out. But apparently...
was his name Pat N. Taturney? It's amazing, though. If you could possibly guess my name, he says, covering up the name badge he's been wearing for 20 minutes. Unbelievable. Unbelievable.
So,
scenes.
And it then became a huge part of early 20th century life. So many of them were sold. In May 1920, Norman Rockwell, who was the illustrator of American 20th century domesticity, depicted a man and a woman on a Saturday night, sat on the cover of the Saturday Evening Post, communing with spirits on a Ouija board. It was understandably quite popular during the Great Depression because it was a time of great tumult and instability, so people would find comfort in it. And the person who sort of took over the production of them was an employee of Elijah Bond, a man called William Fuld. And he started production of his own boards under the name Ouija. Fuld had worked at the Kenod Novelty Company as a varnisher, and he originally trademarked the board as, under the name Oracle in 1902. And what he then did is he started suing other companies who had talking boards who he thought would infringe on his trademarks. But he may not have taken himself very seriously because he used lots of various publicity stunts, including my favourite publicity stunt was that if he made a cheaper version of his own product, he would get more business. So he introduced in 1919 the Mystifying Oracle, which was an exact replica of his own Ouija board that sold for less money. So he basically had like the deluxe board and the economy board. He also launched a line of trademark Ouija jewellery, a Ouija oil for rheumatism. He trademarked the names Egyptian Luck Board, Hindu Luck Board, WE-JA. As well as trademarking all the different ways that the patterns on the board would be displayed and the name itself.
There's something immediately suspicious about anyone who's so patent-go-lucky in my eyes.
Yeah. It reached its height, I think, in 1944. A single New York department store sold over 5 months. How many do you reckon it sold over 5 months?
Oh, 60,000.
Oh, not far off, 50,000.
Oh.
But its biggest hype was in 1967. It was a year after the Fold Company had sold Ouija boards to which company?
Hasbro.
So close. That's who currently owns it.
Milton Bradley.
The Parker Brothers.
Parker Brothers. I've gotten there eventually. Amazing, of course.
And how many copies were sold in 1967 in
America? With Parker Brothers behind it and with the, yeah... quarter of a million.
2 million.
What?
Yep.
Hang on. I didn't adjust for 60s drug intake.
Fair. And it outsold Monopoly.
Yes! Anything outselling Monopoly.
Who wouldn't want to play a game of Ouija Monopoly?
Imagine if Ouija board was like the board game people all play over Christmas instead of Monopoly.
Brilliantly, is my final thing to tell you about Elijah Bond, who was the original man behind it. When he died, he was buried in an unmarked grave, and it was very difficult to find. And Robert Murch, the journalist who wrote about this, eventually located the grave in Baltimore's Green Mount Cemetery, and he worked closely with the cemetery owners, and together they funded a new headstone for him, which has the depiction of a Ouija board on it.
That is the creepiest fucking headstone in human history.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, but all that ever gets spelt out on it is woo.
Yeah. Did they ever try and gamify it, Parker Brothers? Like, did they ever try and sell it with, like, rules, or was it just selling it as
No, I think it was just... I mean, it was still sort of sold as a toy in a game, but I don't think they tried to do any more to it to turn it into an actual competition. It was just... It's just what it was.
They did, and it turned into Scrabble.
That's why Scrabble is very popular in old people's homes, because death is not the impediment to a good game that it used to be. There you go, my friends. That is this month's Third Foot. We hope that you have enjoyed it. We hope that you have a thoroughly spooky and enjoyable Halloween. We hope that your tricks are well deployed and your treats are delicious.
Indeed you do. That's goodbye from me, and it's goodbye from Ben. Ben. Oh, good. I thought he'd left me. Bye, folks.
Bye.